During the war, not many of the locals from Ohoreau went away to war. The Reeds' son, the Reeds lived on the way on the right, left, the one house before Eastwick's, just before you got over the hill. Their son went away to war and didn't come back. He, Mum and Dad were terribly upset. He was Prue's godfather. But most of the rest of the people in the valley by the 1942 or so had one child, and I remember Mum saying when I was born in 1942, they were at the stage where they were starting to call up people with conscript people with two or more children. So mind your Dad had flat feet, so that ruled him out of it. But they did have the Home Guard, which I think was a bit like Dad's army. And they, you know, farmers do turn things into a bit of humour. But I found this lovely little piece Dad had written about the Home Guard. If I can find it. The Home Guard formed during the war. Harry had a mounted troop, mainly farmers and those that were unable or not fit for service overseas, self-included. Dad had flat feet. Our job was to stop enemy landing from Cook Strait. We were armed with old 303 rifles and one live cartridge. Otherwise, we were supposed to roll boulders down the cliffs on the enemy. Gilbert Bruce was our CO, then Reg Best and Hugh Mackay, our sergeant. I still have photos of our troop. Some I can remember, Jim and Laurie Hume, Owen and Reg Beach, Keith Best, self, George Jeff Smith, Bill Page, Bill Shaw, Mick Bryant, Rolly Firkins, Jack Nelson, Peter Aronson, Tom Horriban, Frank Saunders, Joe Jellyman, Don Gordon and Ted Locke. Our uniform was an ordinary army jacket, riding trousers with puffies to wrap around your legs starting on the top of your boot and continuing almost up to your knees. Very comfortable to ride in, also army greatcoat. I had the job on Fridays to pick up our rations for the week and weekends. Bread, bully beef and horse rations. Some of the horses only saw hard feed then and often went down with colic. Some of the bully beef was at least half fat, but some Californian beef was great. Some people in headquarters must have lived on it for years to come. There was no check on what you took. I remember Mum telling me once that the twins were babies and she had them sitting on a rug on the lawn and she looked out the window to see all these men lying on their stomachs crawling across the front lawn past these twins. That must have been a training exercise. But yes, they... So, you know, that was what they did. Dad had flat feet, but it never stopped him walking the hills. He said once that he took a copper over on, strung over the old pack horse, and on the way over the hill, the horse slipped and fell on the copper and squashed it. So they always had a crooked copper to boil their water in over at the camp.
Do you know where the camp was or not?
No, I don't know where the camp was. I would think there'd been more. There had to be more than one because it would have. They would have covered the coastline from Eastwick's to Macra, I would think. But there was an army road that nobody was allowed to use. It was a good metal road too, from Eastwick's to Titahi Bay. And once Dad was asked to bring a horse. There was been problems with this horse, and Dad was very good with horses, so he was asked to bring this horse back from Titahi Bay, I think, or almost up there. And Mr. Shaw went with him, and I remember we were allowed to go in the car, and they had all these keys, And we went through, I think we left the gates unlocked on the way up. And then Dad picked up the horse, and then he rode the horse down, and Mr. Shaw drove the car. And at every gate we had to stop, take the car through, or open the gate, take the car through, lock the gate behind us. Then he had to run down to the, down a few hundred feet, open the stop gate, let Dad on the horse through, then run up, and then repeat the same. And I, as I recall, there just seemed a lot of gates. It was dark by the time we got home, but Dad bought that. I don't know why they bought that horse through. Dad used to often be given difficult horses to school again to make them rideable. He had one from Terafuti Station that he spent a lot of time with, and he had it very docile and it worked well, and he sent it back to Terafuti and with a lot of instructions, and next thing we heard he'd taken back to his old ways, and he threw a man and killed him. So sort of about then I think motorbikes and tractors came in, and Dad went out of horses. And we always had two horses on the farm for the farm work. And then when I was at primary school, we got an Oliver tractor. There's one in the museum up at Te Whawhiti, I think it is up near Taranaki, Harawa, I think it is. Just like our little tractor. It came in boxes, and it took the men all day to assemble it in the cow yard. But that was our first crawler tractor. Bests had had one not long before, and then some years later, a few years later, Bests got a pickup press. And after Dad had all his hay cut for the contractor to come, and it rained for a week solidly, the next year we got a pickup press. And after that, Dad would go round and he'd press hay for Bryant's and Hume's, because those sheep farmers only wanted a small amount of hay, and Dad, they would just have a paddock full, and Dad would go down, and they would usually return the favour and some form of labour for, you know, hay making or something else for Dad, as the farmers did. Money didn't change hands, but they always helped out. And, we went to a Harry school. We were in the new school up on top on the hill. Mm-hmm. It was about, I think we got up to about 24 in the little building, which we called, they now call the old school, but the one on the bottom field had burnt down previously. I don't know where, but the story goes that one of the best, whether it was, I think Mr. Reg Best's father, saw the building burning, rushed down, had an axe in his hand, and made a hole in the water tank to get the water, but it was too low, and they lost most of the water before they could think about putting out the fire. Also in the school ground was the little library. I don't know who owned that, whether it was Education Department or what, but people used to use it as a library. It was about the size of a garage. And then for some reason or other, it was just bulldozed. We had by that time the National Library van that came out, and a group of women used to go and choose all these books, and Mum got into it later on as we got a wee bit older, and everybody got about a dozen books, I think. So they, half a dozen women selected the books, then when they were made up into bundles and delivered round, and every month that bundle got moved on, and they used to get very cross if somebody hadn't finished reading a particular book and wouldn't pass it on just then. They used to sort of hound them to keep the bundles fairly normal. They must have had, so much fiction and so much non-fiction. So, and then every 6 months or so, the van came round. It got to be very big, in the end, the van got to be very big. And that was the know, the way the it worked. But of course by then petrol was becoming a bit more, a bit easier to get, so I think people were able to get out more, and so they weren't quite such a self-contained society. We went to college, the twins and June Gordon were due to start college, and Dad started checking with the education department, and because we were over 4 miles from the school, they realised that they could get a taxi. And well, they had to have education supplied transport. So suddenly they sent a taxi for these three girls. The next year there was five, because Janet and Robin started. And then Douglas and Jean Gordon and myself started. So somewhere along the line we got up to two taxis, all going into colleges. And then it got even bigger when Onslow College opened. Donald Best was a foundation pupil then. It caused a few problems because he chose to play cello, which was a bit tricky to fit that in the taxi as well as all the kids. And, you know, of course, country kids, very rude. They were not about anybody who wanted to do something a wee bit different. So I think they gave Donald a bit of a hard time about his cello.
Donald became a
really
good player, wasn't he, in the
quartet? Yeah, yes, he followed it through, so, you know, he stuck with it, but he wasn't a sporty person, so that was his thing. But as I say, you know, country kids just give those sort of people a hard time. During the time that we were going to college in taxis, there were still cows moving around the roads then, but, you know, because Alcox was still in business and Dad had the farm, Dad was the last one to, my brother-in-law bought the herd, so that would have been about 1961, it'd be later than that, possibly 63, 64 that my brother-in-law built, or even later. And he took the herd to Manukau. Yes, no, the children were quite old, so it would have been in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the last one. Alcox had gone before then, and by then O'Harrier was being opened up to lifestyle blocks, and the whole nature of the place was changing.
So it had changed from dairying to sheep, what was left of the farming?
Well, there were... Some of the hill was just was not right for dairying, so there was some Bests, once the boys, I don't know that they were that keen. They had Max Beach who milked for a long time, but as they got more land they went to sheep, and I think the wool boom helped things along. They changed. Bryant's had always been sheep with just a couple of house cows, you know, it was hard going, and a cold southerly could really put the milk quota, you know, quantities down considerably, which is why Dad built the big barn to feed the cows inside and keep them out of the weather on occasions. But we thought it was so exciting, and it must have been such hard work to get those cows in there, feed them inside, clean out. And they must have dreaded it, but, you know, to us as children it was exciting.
Yeah.
Going up there and seeing it all happen.
Yeah. Must be quite strange overseas where they went to the more inside, you know?
Yes, it is. I mean, it was that principle of the overseas wintering inside.
Mm.
Dad, Mr. Reg Best was quite committee-minded. We shared a party line with his children, and there was Mr. Best with his things. Dad was on the school committee and the vicar's warden at the church. Dad had been on the school committee from the time the twins went to school till Mary finished, I think, at primary school. And he had been the vicar's warden at the church, the Anglican church, from the time his father left the district, so that was 1938. And then Mr. Best died very suddenly. He was on the Hutt County and some other committees, and he died very suddenly at the age of 62, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And Dad was asked to stand for the Hutt County, which was the area that Hutt County Council had the Makra riding, the Wainui riding, the Horokiri riding, which I think was Ahatanui up to Plimoton, Pycock, and most of the Kapiti area, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And Dad was elected as a Makra representative there, Makra O'Hariu representative. And when the boundaries were all changed and Kapiti Coast Council came in, Wainui was taken into the Hutt City Council and Makra was taken into Wellington City Council, Makra O'Hariu. And Dad went as that representative there. And then after a certain length of time, he had to be just go on the council list to be, you know, to be elected, and he was elected. Dad went onto the onto the Wellington City Council when he was, when Frank Kitts was mayor, and well, I'm trying to think who was mayor when he came off. He went right through with Michael Fowler, and Ian Lawrence was there. During that time, he was their representative on the Hutt Milk, well, Wellington City Milk Corporation. He was also the farmer's representative at the same time, I think, at the Hutt Milk Corporation. And I think ultimately they combined. But he was also councillor responsible for civil defence, which he felt was a very... nobody was interested in civil defence, and he found that a very hard portfolio. Because, but during that time, he also got very involved with the Hydatids Council and the Noxious Weeds Council. A friend of ours had Hydatids, so Dad was very staunch on that one. And you know, they had the, and those were the days of the dog dosing strips and things. And the the Noxious Weeds, yes, well, they did try and, you know, Dad was scrupulous on the farm, trying to keep the gorse down.
Yeah.
And used to really upset him. I notice there's a lot more, the pretty mauve flowers on the sides of the motorways that are there in spring, which is a form of ragwort which just takes over. And town people say how pretty it looks, and it used to really rile Dad. But that, you know, he used to go for Sunday drives, and it was as much as anything to look at noxious weeds. What he always noticed, two had, you know, too much gorse, and then they would sort of get a little notice from the noxious weed board to say it was time they did some spray.
He worked overtime.
Every day, a courier used to come out to the farm with an envelope, or several envelopes, just depending, and there was a huge amount of reading. I don't think people realise how much reading there was to keep up with council, what was happening within council. And then you'd get calls from different people. But, you know, it didn't take long to realise that you just couldn't cope with everybody's little individual requests, so they'd, you know, they'd know who to, you know, put people, refer people on. But, you know, there's one councillor told Dad, don't get caught like I did. He said, I found I was running down the road after the dustman was in my neighbour's rubbish bin. He said, don't get into that sort of, you know, there just wasn't time.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, hugely time consuming.
Yeah.
The one beauty of it was that Mum, who, you know, if she wanted to go to town, she always kept, Dad had a council car park, and Mum always kept a piece of fruit and a book in the car, and she'd just wander Wellington streets, and she just loved the city, and she'd have a lunch in town, and then she'd go back and wait for Dad. He'd give her an estimate of when he thought he would be back at the car, and she would go back and wait in the car and just read her book.
Yeah.
And that suited them fine, and they did that for many years.
Yeah. Yeah. So your mother was really a little bit of a townie at heart, or not? Or just a change?
It was, I think, you know, she was a country kid, and she always said she couldn't live in town, but, and luckily she never had to.
Yeah.
But she missed town, and she used to go to all the exhibitions, you know, go and see all the exhibitions that were on and the galleries, and she just loved having, you know, coffee and a cake or lunch, and always finished up her lunch with a cake.
Yeah.
And she used to have, from the time we were little, if we went to town, which was only about once a fortnight, they'd go on Friday afternoons, but Mum used to bring home this little packet of ground coffee, carefully put it into a jar, and then simmer it and on the stove, and then strain it and have her a cup of coffee. But nobody else drank coffee. But I think because she'd been to the continent, she enjoyed her coffee, but she just didn't get it much. Yeah. And there's fags in Lower Cuba Street that used to grind the coffee that she had. And it was, you know, now, people couldn't live without their cups of coffee. But, you know, so that was when we were primary school, so that was probably early 50s.
Yeah. I think Dad's mum used to have coffee essence. That's the only coffee I ever tasted.
We tried coffee essence too, but it was in a bottle. Mum hated that. So, as I say, her little indulgence was a little packet of Adams Bruce chocolates and this packet of coffee, and nobody ever wanted to share the coffee. She used to sort of always offer it to Dad and things, and but no, he, you know, at that stage he wasn't interested. So yes, so she's found time, you know, and she just enjoyed going to town, and she read a lot, so she spent a lot of time at the library, mostly Johnsonville Library. And when she died, we found a book. She was starting to worry that she was getting repeat books out. So she had this little notebook where she would record what she had read. And yes, she used to enjoy getting into the Wellington Library as well, because that sort of had a bigger, much bigger pool of books.
Well, it would have been a mobile library in Johnsonville for a while,
wouldn't it? No, I think there was always a library in Johnsonville. So she was quite thrilled when they grew the bigger one, you know, they built the bigger one. And Dad was on the licensing, Dad was elected to the licensing trust.
Burma Lodge,
That's right, yes, I remember seeing the plans to Burma Lodge when they were building that, but with Egan Ogier and, I can't remember, Tom Craddock, I think, but they were the foundation members on that one, and they got I remember when they built Broderick in, because Ray upset Egan Ogier because they bought Ray's parents' property, the cabbage tree that was in the corner of the front garden was still there, and Ray said, well, did that mean he got a free car park? Which didn't go down too well. But yes, the Broderick and the, I saw the plans for the Burma Lodge. And so that was a big thing. And then, yes, Dad's Parkinson's made it difficult for him to,
I didn't love him then.
Yes. He had Parkinson's, and as he found it more difficult to get around, he found it, he lost confidence, which was difficult. Because at Wellington City Council, he was also the Queen Elizabeth Park Board Council representative on that one too.
It's quite a lot of responsibility, isn't it?
Once my brother-in-law took over as share milker, Dad devoted most of his time to, an awful lot of his time to the council.
Yeah.
And then he just, he did things on the farm, but it was really just sort of fences and little maintenance things.
Yeah.
But the actual running of the farm he left to Barry. Yeah. And then when Barry took the herd, Dad bought sheep. And that was a whole new learning curve. We didn't have a clue. He bought these sheep that had been out the back of Wainui. And he came home, he'd been away with the Licensing Trust on a trip, a conference, and they came back that weekend and the herd had gone. And for the first time he looked out at the hills and they were bare, no animals. And he was just devastated, and he rushed out and he bought these sheep, and they were wild. And they jumped gates, and they went under gates, and they just took off. And he used to, when he wanted to move them, he used to grab all the grandchildren and take them down and stand them in the neighbours' gateways. and then we had to go too sometimes, and then they would drive the sheep down and, with all his human dogs. And I can remember the first shearing, they jumped out of the, we took them down to Gordon's woolshed, and they jumped out of the pens, they jumped out of the yards, and one had couple had lambs in the yards, and I can remember having to drive the little van home with the old ram and a couple of lambs in the back of it, and somebody else had to drive the sheep, but I got this horrible old ram sort of breathing down my neck as I drove back up.
But you didn't feel much empathy for sheep?
No, we didn't get on well with sheep, but then to keep Dad on the farm, John Hume came up with this wonderful idea. His mum and dad were, in their late 70s, and Dad and John formed a partnership, and John kept his sheep an extra year, and they ran them on Dad's Easy Country, and John did the lambing work, and it was lovely because it kept Dad on the land. Yes, and I think, after Dad died, that John just sold the old sheep, he just sold an extra amount and got rid of them, and that was it. Yes, yeah. And they did a bit of hay. It was handy to have a bit of hay there for the horse riders.
Mm-hmm.
By that time there was a lot of horses in the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And they would always wanted to buy hay, so Dad and John kept hay. Gavin Bruce used to do most of the work for that. He somehow got involved in that one too.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to just keep pressing hay for the horse riders. Yes, that was when Dad was in the council, Seton Ossiter Park. They knew he was a bit involved, in the country, and they couldn't find a name for that park in Paparangi, and several other names had been discarded, and somebody off the top of their head just said, how about Seton Ossett Park? It went through unanimously, and that was it. And I think Dad was quite thrilled because it was a very natural sort of park. It still is.
Yeah.
And he was quite thrilled with that.
Nice way for his name to be carried on.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a flat sports field or anything.
Yeah.
Mostly dogs down there now.
Okay.
Dogs down there. One time they thought that they might have to use it as a flood area, but I think that's been discounted because they felt that the weight of the water might just wash out the motorway.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to laugh because there is a Lake Seton in Canada. It was British Columbia after one of the family some years back, so I thought that would be quite ironical.